grab the baby, river's rising. Old frame house, she can't take one more beat.
This is part two of Come Hell or High Water, Remembering the Great Flood of 1916, a four-part audio documentary based on the film by David Weintraub. I'm Kim Clark. Yesterday, we heard some powerful stories that have been handed down from survivors of the Great Flood in the Bat Cave area of Henderson County. There, hundreds of mudslides came crashing down the sides of the mountains, taking trees, boulders, homes, entire farms, and entire families with them. Today, we turn our attention to the mountains of McDowell County. The Orchard at Alta Pass sits atop the Eastern Continental Divide, above the watersheds of the North Tow River and the North Fork of the Catawba. The orchard was developed by the Clinchfield Railroad around 1910 and is owned and managed for conservation and heritage today by Bill Carson, a former NASA engineer. Since coming to the orchard in the 1990s, Carson has been collecting stories from the area, including those about the 1916 flood. We're going to turn the next several minutes of the program over to this master storyteller, Bill Carson.
Well, we have a lot of people that come through the orchard, and I love to tell them the stories about the place. And here at Alta Pass, one of the premier stories is what happened in 1916. In 1916, two hurricanes in a row came through here in a week's time. First one from the Gulf of Mexico brought 10 or 12 inches of rain and rained for several days. And within a week, one came from the Atlantic Ocean, following basically the Catawba River Basin all the way up. And that one was the one that set the record here at Alta Pass. Alta Pass held the record for rainfall in 24 hours for the whole United States for several years. 22.22 inches of rain fell in one 24-hour period, measured here at Alta Pass by the orchard manager and the railroad manager at J.S. Bowen. And so I started collecting stories about that flood, and I started telling them to groups that came through. And we had a group from Avery County called the Lunch Bunch. Requirement to be in the Lunch Bunch, you had to be 90 years old or older. Pretty small group. Well, I started to tell the Lunch Bunch about some of my favorite flood stories. And I was interrupted by a little old lady from the back named Dolly Vance, who raised her hand, and I called on her and she said, "Sonny, I'm going to tell you about the flood of 1916. She told this story. She was a little girl, 5 years old, when this flood happened. She lived with her family in the deepest part of the valley below us, where the water got the highest. In some places, it was 50, 60, 70 feet above flood stage. You could see water, she said, from the far mountain, Linville Mountain, clear back to the Blue Ridge, in the lake in the valley down below. She said on the night of the big rain, her daddy was concerned. They lived right along the North Fork. He went up behind their house, and on the hill behind their house, he built a lean-to. And he came down into the flood, and he woke everybody in the family up. And Dolly Vance, this girl of five, remembered hanging on to Daddy with one hand, Mommy with one hand, being half carried and half dragged through water that was deeper than she'd ever seen before. She said when they got to the hill and started up the hill, the rain was coming so hard it was in her eyes and ears and nose and mouth. It was about like being underwater. She said when we got to the top of the hill, we were under the lean-to, but I was soaking wet and cold and shivering and the wind was blowing. We built a fire that night at the lean-to and I was warm and nearly dry in the morning when I woke up. And when I looked out, I was frightened. During the night, the water had come up all sides of that hill, and now it was an island, and the water was rising, and it wasn't like water rising in a bathtub. It was splashing higher and higher like rapids, tearing away chunks of the hill. She said the water stopped before it got to our lean-to, and then it started down in a big rush also. She said when it got down low enough, we could look down the hill and see where our house used to be, it was gone. We had nothing left but the clothes we were wearing. After a day or two, we came off the mountain and met our neighbors, the McGees, who were looking for three lost children. There was a big cook pot in the front yard, and the flood rose and carried the cook pot away. And that was an important part of their lives, and the parents went to chase that down, not realizing that right behind that was a huge amount of water coming. And so the children were lost when the parents were out trying to save the cook pot. Dolly said, "We found the first one in the mud along the North Fork River." Dolly said, "We couldn't find the second one until the butterflies led us to the body of the second child. The third was a baby sleeping on a mattress, and the mattress carried the baby away before anybody could save it. And now they were looking downstream for the baby or the mattress or whatever. And way up in the top of a big old tree where the highest water had put it was a wad that could have been the mattress. A man climbed the tree, got above the mattress, opened the corners of the mattress, and there was the baby alive. It was a miracle." You know, as time has passed and I think about these events, it put in perspective to me, Ivan and Francis. They were nothing compared to what Dolly lived through, or what could happen again in these mountains the next time the hurricanes come calling.
Storyteller Bill Carson of The Orchard at Altapass. F.C. Abbott, a businessman who was traveling by train from Charlotte to Black Mountain on Saturday, July 15, 1916, was stranded east of Morganton when the train stopped running due to the extensive damage to the track. After a night's rest, he decided to try to finish the trip by other means. Abbott secured an automobile with a courageous driver and headed west. When they reached Marion in McDowell County, they learned that not only was most of the railroad track gone, but the highways were largely destroyed as well. He and two other men decided to trek up the mountain on foot, and he later wrote about his experience. WNCW's Joe Green reads from Abbott's account.
"The scene just above Marion was a wild one. When we came to the large steel railroad bridge over the river approaching this place, we had our toughest experience. The bridge itself was standing all right on its piers, but 50 feet of the approach had been absolutely washed away, leaving the rails swinging in the air with the ties still hanging to them 20 feet above the river below. I've walked many a high trestle in my younger days, and it would have been no special trick to walk the ties on this swinging section of track. But the ties were in bad shape, some of them loose and hanging by a single spike."
Desperate to reach their families and friends in Black Mountain and Asheville, the three travelers crawled across the dangling stretch of track on all fours, their knees on the ties and their hands on the steel rail. They would have to repeat this maneuver several times more on other stretches of dangling track on their way up the mountain to Ridgecrest. When they reached Old Fort, Abbott and his companions met a mountaineer who offered to guide them the rest of the way. He led the men around and through the debris up to the new highway, which later would be U.S. 70.
"As we rounded the last curve of the new automobile highway, there lay before us a terrible scene of destruction. A section of the mountain, nearly 300 feet wide, had slipped out from under the Southern Railroad, leaving the track 60 feet in the air, with all the ties attached, hanging in a deep, graceful loop from crag to crag. Close by, another slide had occurred, carrying with it the roadbed, rails, ties, and all. The two slides had merged just where the new automobile highway crossed, and the combined avalanche had cut through this new highway like so much cheese and had gone thundering down the valley fully 300 feet below. Our mountaineer guide's description of the slide was most striking. He said, 'They tell me a cloudburst did it, but I was just coming down the mountain and saw it done. The water did not come from above. It came from below. The trees on the side of the mountain just popped right out by the roots, with the water spouting after them, and the whole mountain just busted wide open and slid down into the valley.' I believe he was correct. The ground had soaked in all the water it could hold, down to bedrock. And the pressure underneath the soil had become so great that this underground reservoir simply burst out and carried everything with it."
After parting ways with his fellow travelers at Ridgecrest, Mr. Abbott finally reached Black Mountain, 5 days after he had left Charlotte. Near Charlotte, which had only received a little over 5 inches of rain from that second hurricane, thousands of people were gathering on the banks of the Catawba River to watch debris from upstream float by. Heavy timber, parts of bridges, houses, bales of cotton, logs, huge trees, and haystacks passed by, as well as livestock, chickens, and other animals clinging to all kinds of rafts. The water from the torrential rains that had fallen in the highest elevations was making its way downstream, and it was bringing disaster to the mountain communities that had been spared the heaviest rainfall. Asheville had received only a glancing blow from the storm, and night had fallen on Saturday with its residents totally unaware of the volume of floodwater that was headed toward them from the hard-hit areas upstream along the Swannanoa and French Broad Rivers. The situation there deteriorated rapidly on Sunday morning. Henderson County historian Jenny Jones-Giles reads the last communication from Asheville before all the lines went down on the afternoon of July 16, 1916.
This is the last teletype received out of Asheville. Asheville and Biltmore are flooded. The water is up to the ceiling in the depot. It is 6 feet deep in Dr. Elias's house in Biltmore. It is in All Souls Church. It is in the hospital. The beds are floating. The patients are drowning. The tannery is washed away. Bridges are gone. Captain Life and some of the nurses are drowned at Biltmore. Other people are up in trees surrounded by water, and they cannot get them out of the river. The Swannanoa is a mile wide. Boxcars are floating down the French Broad. All the lakes at Hendersonville have broken.
Tomorrow, the aftermath of the Great Flood and stories of everyday people performing extraordinary deeds of courage and selflessness as they work to rescue neighbors and strangers from the floodwaters. This program is a production of WNCW and the Center for Cultural Preservation in Hendersonville, North Carolina. It's based on the film Come Hell or High Water, Remembering the Great Flood of 1916 by David Weintraub, which is currently touring the state of North Carolina and is also available on DVD with more information at saveculture.org. The film was made possible in part by the support of Green River Preserve, Paul and Simone Shoemaker, and Holly Spring Farm. Interviews for this program were conducted and recorded by David Weintraub. The theme music is Muddy Water by The Seldom Seen. The film was adapted for radio by me. I'm Kim Clark. Join us tomorrow for part 3 of Come Hell or High Water, Remembering the Great Flood of 1916.